Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. Today, we begin with coverage of the food stamp program. Last week, the Trump administration approved a new rule that will disqualify some 700,000 people from the Supplemental Nutrition Program, or SNAP. Last year, Congress rejected similar cuts that were put in the Farm Bill. This time, the administration is going around the legislative branch to implement these devastating cuts. Joining us to talk about this and media coverage is Jackie Botts, a reporter with CalMatters and the California Divide. It's a collaboration among newsrooms examining income inequality and economic survival in California. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, Jackie, before we dive in and talk about food stamps, we like to start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what did you see this week that caught your attention?
Yeah, you know, I would point readers to a great investigation that came out of the Fresno Bee, actually by one of my colleagues for the California Divide collaboration, Manuela Tobias. She wrote a story about these medical care cards, medical credit cards that dentists are increasingly using, encouraging patients to get dental care and then pay for it using these credit cards, and sort of the complex way that these can end up building up to be a lot of debt for patients who didn't totally understand what they were getting into. So I really highly recommend that investigation. It was a fascinating read.
Wow, that's so important because for so many people, they don't have dental insurance and it is very expensive.
Right.
And since you brought up the California Divide, can you just tell us about that collaboration?
Yeah, sure. It's really exciting. So I'm a part of a team of newsrooms and reporters who are working together to cover economic inequality, financial hardship, and also financial survival throughout California. We are about 35 newspapers and currently, I think, 5 reporters who are covering these stories locally in our communities in Los Angeles, Fresno, Salinas, Bay Area, and as well as at the state level. That's me.
That's fantastic, because at a time when so many newsrooms are cutting back or laying people off, I mean, these kinds of initiatives are really important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and you can find a link at yourcallradio.org. You can also go to calmatters.org/divide. They report that nearly half of California's 40 million residents live in poverty or they're on the brink, with the vast majority in working households. A housing shortage has spiked prices to more than 2.5 times the national average and fueled a crisis in homelessness. Wow, half of California's residents living in poverty or they're on the brink. Well, let's just start with California. Since it's such a massive state, how will Californians be affected by Trump's food stamp cuts?
Yeah, so the Urban Institute, which is a think tank in D.C., estimates that about 198,000 Californians stand to lose their food stamp benefits under the new rule that was finalized last week. And that's actually just one of 3 rules that the Trump administration has proposed that would cut food stamps. So were all 3 rules to go into effect, that would affect around 3.7 million Americans, including an estimated 625,700 Californians.
Hey, what is the pushback against this, Jackie? Because a lot of politicians have successfully stopped this in the past.
Yeah, so let me give you a little bit of a breakdown of what this last rule that was finalized last week actually does, and then I can explain what the pushback has been and also what the rationale from the federal government is. So under current law, able-bodied adults who don't have dependents and who work less than 20 hours a week can only qualify for 3 months of food stamps every 3 years. It's an old rule, and the idea is to encourage adults to work. But states and counties can waive those limits and have considerable flexibility to waive that work requirement or that time limit on food stamp benefits for those people. And what this rule does is make it a lot harder for counties to drop that work requirement. So, for example, right now in California, all but six counties have waivers, and that work requirement is just not happening in California, and this rule would undo that. So the pushback comes from politicians and anti-hunger advocates who say that this is, on the one hand, cruel, but on the other hand, ineffective, because they argue that taking food away from people doesn't make them more productive. They say that not knowing where your next meal is coming from might make it harder for you to find work rather than, you know, the opposite way. But the federal government is clear in that the point of this change is to decrease government dependency. So Sonny Perdue, who is the secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, said, and I quote, "We need to encourage people by giving them a helping hand, but not allowing it to become an indefinitely giving hand." Mm.
Let's just talk about how you qualify for food stamps and what the average monthly allotment is, because that is often missing from especially radio pieces about food stamps.
Sure, yeah. So how food stamps works is that it's money for groceries that comes on a card. It looks and feels like a credit card. And in California, we call it CalFresh. Food stamps is actually sort of the old name for it, and technically the federal government calls it SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. In California, the average CalFresh household gets about $272 per month for their whole family, and that comes out on average to about $3 per meal for each person.
And that is for a family of how many?
That's for the average-sized family, which is a little bit more than two people.
So $3 per meal for two people.
Yeah, it's $3 per meal per person.
Per person. Okay, so $3.
Yeah.
And then what if you're single? What is the average for a single person?
You know, I don't have that off the top of my head right now.
Okay, but I think it's around $3 a meal. Now, yeah, those of us know, even, you know, outside of the very expensive Bay Area, it's very hard to eat for $3 per meal. I mean, I know that people don't use the $3 per meal. They use the, let's say, a week's worth, right, to go buy groceries.
Right.
But it's really hard to buy groceries with such a low amount of money.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a lot.
Right. So why don't you think, Jackie, do you think that the human aspect of this gets enough attention? Because I don't really hear the $3 per meal amount when I'm listening to radio pieces about this.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I was really surprised to learn that it was only that much money. But what I was also surprised to learn was how much of a difference that really makes for people. Mm. You know, you talk to people who can just tick off every single expense every single bill they're going to have to pay for this month, and there isn't extra money in there for food, right? So getting that $3 per meal can make all the difference. In a lot of cases, people who are getting CalFresh are also taking advantage of community resources like food banks.
And also, it's really hard to apply. You have written a story about college students in Fresno who struggle with hunger, one who's applied for food stamps three times. Why was it so hard for her to apply for food stamps?
Sure. So That is sort of the issue that California has been dealing with for a long time. We actually have unusually low rates of participation in food stamps compared to the rest of the country. I think in 2016 we had the fifth lowest participation rate, signing up just around 72% of eligible people. And students, seniors, immigrants, people who are working during the day, and homeless people are all make up the groups that participate at particularly low rates. In the case of the student who I spoke to, she was dealing with a student eligibility requirement that makes it really hard for students to get on the program. in a lot of cases, which is that federal law bars full-time students from receiving CalFresh benefits unless they meet one of several exceptions or they're working at least 20 hours per week. And this student that I talked with had a inconsistent work schedule. Sometimes she was working way more than that, and sometimes she was working way less. She applied three times, and each time couldn't prove to the Fresno County that she was indeed working sufficient hours to also qualify for food stamps while she was going to school.
Can you talk about just what she deals with, how hard it is for her to go to school? And, I mean, this is just so not being able to eat, how hard it is to concentrate, how, I mean, when you're hungry, how hard it is just to function overall.
Sure, yeah. I'll tell you about another student I spoke with who lives in Sacramento. She's a Sacramento City College student. Her name is Beverly. She's 20 years old, and she recently is on her own after leaving a family situation that she described as abusive. She's actually homeless right now and living in a shelter. And she gets free dinners there at the shelter with the cheapest foods that she can find. She eats canned soup, pancakes, granola bars. She is often skipping lunch. And she said that she goes to bed hungry very often, and she wasn't able to get CalFresh because she applied twice because she wasn't working the required 20 hours per week the first two times that she applied. She went on to get a job and was working more than that, but at that point she was sort of so exhausted from the application process that she decided not to apply again. But she described being in class to me and her brain just sort of feeling hazy and slow, and so she would write down everything that she was hearing as fast as she could so she wouldn't have to process it in the moment when her brain didn't have enough nutrition to sort of do that work. And then later, after she'd had a meal, she'd go back and she'd read her notes.
Mm. Well, what is the reasoning behind requiring college students who are struggling with hunger, trying to get an education, to make them work 20 hours a week?
So this is a federal rule, and it according to one of my sources, Jessica Barthlow, who is a policy advocate at the Western Center on Law and Poverty, she says that it kind of comes from this mythology of students coming from more elite and middle-class homes, and the idea of student hunger sort of being like a rite of passage rather than something that really seriously affected their ability to do school. And so there's this view of school as being something where you sort of get your grit, but for families who are already, for students who are already coming from families that grapple with hunger, it can be really, really serious to not have enough money to cover your basic expenses while you're in school.
This is such a strange idea, given that now we have food pantries on college campuses across the country.
That's right.
And there are now homeless clinics and in schools from kindergarten up. I mean, this is like, this is a major crisis.
It is. You know, in a 2018 survey at 23 California State University campuses, more than 40% of students actually reported being food insecure, and 1 in 10 said that they experienced homelessness in the past year. That was just that school system, but the statistics at other schools in many cases are higher.
You also interviewed a 61-year-old in-home caretaker in Oakland who was cut off from food stamps last year when her paperwork got lost. Out of work, she cannot afford groceries.
Yeah, that's right. And I do have good news. An update is that she reapplied a year later, and she was able to get the benefit and got the full amount that a single person can get, which is $194. But what happened with her is actually quite common. It's something that's called churn, and listeners who themselves receive food stamps may very well have experienced this. It's the phenomenon of applying, getting on the program, and then falling off for some reason. So it could be because you failed to meet kind of the very brief window in which you're supposed to turn in your six-month report verifying that you're still eligible, or your annual report. It could be because your paperwork got lost or there was some confusion with your eligibility worker. But it's really quite common, and that's one of the reasons that advocates point to is why California perhaps has a low participation rate, is that so often people are getting on the program and just as quickly falling off. Mm.
Today we're talking about food stamp cuts and what it will mean for so many people across the country. We're also discussing media coverage, and I always just wonder why this $3 number is not widely known, since we hear so much about food stamps and this conservative line that people are taking advantage of the program. How do you take advantage of a program when it's $3 a meal? What questions do you have for Jackie? What are your thoughts about how food stamps are covered in the media? Jackie Botts is a reporter with CalMatters. She's also part of the California Divide, a collaboration among newsrooms examining income inequality and economic survival in California, a state with so much inequality. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Jackie, you mentioned immigration, and you have a story about Evangelina Castaneda. Her husband passed away. Food stamps really helped her family make ends meet. But now she's 62 years old and she doesn't want to depend on government assistance. She says, I have fear that I will lose my paper. She's originally from Mexico, but she's a lawful permanent resident. She's been that way for decades. She says it's a little scary because of Trump. I hear what he says sometimes in the news.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a concern that has become increasingly common among immigrant communities since early 2017, according to many food bank outreach workers who I spoke with. And I spoke with a lot of food bank outreach workers because in many cases they're the people who are signing people up for CalFresh. So they really understand who the hard-to-reach people are, and immigrants make up a huge group of that. They always have because of language barriers and fears, but those fears are increasing. One big reason for that is that is a public charge rule. So the Trump administration first leaked a version of this rule that would make it harder for immigrants to get a green card if they were likely to use safety net benefits like food stamps or Medicaid early on in his presidency, and then finalized the rule in August, and soon after it was actually blocked in the federal court, so it hasn't gone into effect. But even so, it's caused many people within the immigrant community to fear that taking advantage of public benefit programs will in some way affect theirs or a family member's application for citizenship in the future.
And Evangelina said she usually has enough to eat. When she doesn't, she picks up boxes from the food bank or attends meals at a local church. Of her four adult children, she told you, they don't know I go to these places to eat food. I'm not going to tell them because they have their own families.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that perspective is also, it's not only common amongst immigrants, but it's also really common amongst seniors. And she's a senior as well. You know, a concern about not wanting to take too much, a fair amount of stigma or shame about taking advantage of public benefit programs.
Jackie, you report that a number of Democrats in the Sacramento legislature are really fighting to ensure that as many people as possible, those who are eligible, actually receive their food stamps. And as you report, the food stamp case, each food stamp case costs about $808 to administer compared to the national average of $348. It's one of the highest cost places in the country. The salaries are higher. The cost of living is higher. Of course, workers want humane benefits. So that would make sense. And so I just wonder, what are your thoughts on this? What are local and state politicians doing to fight back against these cuts?
That's a great question. So in terms of fighting back against the federal cuts, I would not be surprised if we end up seeing a lawsuit from our Attorney General here in California, Javier Becerra, against the Trump administration for one or several of these food stamp cuts, given his track record of consistently suing the Trump administration on, at this point, well over 50 different things, including that public charge rule I just mentioned. But at a more local level, California is a unique place when it comes to food stamps because each county administers the program separately. That's one of the reasons why many people think that we might have low participation, because there's a lot of bureaucracy and different counties have different standards. But there's also some benefits to that, which is that counties that have really high immigrant populations or really high senior populations can cater specifically to the needs of their community. And there's been a ton of work happening recently, especially around reaching out to seniors and students at the county level to get more people enrolled. So on a positive note, I'd say, you know, we have this data showing low participation in California consistently over many years, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see increases in those participation rates in the coming years.
And Jackie, I just wonder, do you read stories about food stamps at the national level as this administration, I mean, you know, continues to cut programs for people who need them the most? How do you think the media are covering these issues?
You know, that's a great question. I will say I haven't seen a lot of people's personal stories in the coverage. I see a lot of sort of the administrative language about what this all means, how it's all going to work, but it can be hard to make the connection between what that looks like on paper and what that actually means for someone who relies on some extra money to help them pay for groceries each month.
Right. It just seems like so many are still allowing the Republicans to frame the issue, even though, you know, a lot of the information they put out there is just not true. There was an op-ed in the New York Times by Margaret Purvis, who runs the Food Bank for New York City, and she writes, "I run a food bank and I know no amount of charity will make up for this cruel policy." So what do you think will happen with this new rule?
You know, that's a great question, and I wouldn't want to pretend that I can look into the crystal ball and guess, but like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if we see states suing the federal government on this rule, like states have sued the federal government on other similar rules that sort of took aim at safety net programs. And so a judge could theoretically block this before it goes into effect or after. And then the other thing that I'd be interested in seeing, though it's quite a few years out, is what will happen with the next U.S. Farm Bill, which will probably be passed sometime in 2023, where all of these questions and all of these proposals perennially come up.
Right. And Margaret from the Food Bank in New York says that this is supposed to take effect in April. Like you said, there will be lawsuits. She says it'll strip 6.2 billion meals from Americans over the next decade.
Wow, that's a huge number.
Well, Jackie, thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really great to talk to you.
You too. Thank you. Jackie Botts is a reporter with Cal Matters and the California Divide. It's a collaboration among newsrooms examining income inequality and economic survival in California. And you can find more reporting about these proposed food stamp cuts and how you can get involved. It's really important to read stories and spread the word about this at a time when it's really hard to keep up with all of this. But there's some decent reporting out there, and Jackie did a great job of actually interviewing people to find out how they will directly be impacted. Coming up after a break, we will talk about media coverage of the Afghanistan papers. It's a massive trove of government documents obtained by the Washington Post detailing how U.S. officials from the Bush, Obama, and Trump administration misled and lied to the public about the 18-year war in Afghanistan. Where are the Afghan voices in all of this? We will speak with two reporters from Afghanistan. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the United States war in Afghanistan and the recent publication of the Afghanistan papers by the Washington Post. On Monday, the Post published a confidential trove of government documents detailing how senior U.S. officials failed to tell the truth about the war in Afghanistan over the last 18 years and instead made rosy pronouncements they knew to be false. The documents were generated by a federal several project examining the root failures of the longest armed conflict in U.S. history. These papers include more than 2,000 pages of previously unpublished notes of interviews with 400 people who played a direct role in the war, from generals and diplomats to aid workers and Afghan officials. To get a reaction and what this report means to Afghans who bear the brunt of this war, we are joined by two journalists. Emran Faraz is an independent journalist and author and founder of the Drone Memorial. It's a virtual memorial for civilian drone strike victims. Emran's work has appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times and the Atlantic, and Emran joins us from Berlin. Hi, Emran. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Ali Latifi, a freelance journalist based in Kabul, Afghanistan, and Ali joins us on Skype. Hi, Ali. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you both. I'm so glad we have both of you because I've been listening to reports about the Afghan papers. I have not heard one Afghan in all of these stories. And this has been getting a lot of attention over the last week. I should also point out that in these interviews, more than 600 people were interviewed, but only 20 Afghan officials were interviewed. So, Ali, let's start off with you. What is your reaction to the reporting on this?
I guess as someone, you know, who, I mean, it's not surprising that that's all I can say is that there's really nothing in it from what I've read of it that's, you know, I mean, so Marshal Fahim was a bad man. So Bush, Obama, and Trump all lied about their progress in the war. So these projects failed and there was all kinds of ridiculous spending on it that really didn't add up to very much or were essentially just entire flops, complete flops. I mean, to be quite honest, not to sound entirely cynical, but I think as someone who is Afghan and who lives here, it's really not expected. It's sort of one of the, it's like finding out the Titanic sinks at the end of the movie.
What are your thoughts, Emran?
Well, I wasn't really surprised because, to be honest, as far as I've read the papers, most of the things were already known. And especially a lot of local experts, you know, Afghan experts and analysts who were observing the war, but also non-Afghan critics of the war, were saying this over and over again. But back then, you know, if the people who said this were Afghans, they were just called or described as Taliban supporters, and the people who were non-Afghans were described as anti-Americans or something like that. But, yeah, I wasn't really surprised at all.
Ali, what has the reaction been to this report in Afghanistan? What are you hearing from other people?
I mean, if you look at it's not necessarily, you know, sort of everyday topic of conversation here because, you know, there's still an election dispute. There was just a bombing at the Bagram base. A Japanese aid worker was killed by unknown gunmen. So there's a lot of other things happening. It has been coming up a little bit. It comes up online, and there are some people who sort of, I guess they seem shocked or sort of as if they were caught off guard by it. You know, people who obviously benefit from this war, who, you know, have something to gain from keeping it going and who have made names for themselves throughout this war. But in general, because, you know, if you really, I mean, it's an English language paper, but so if you were to really present this to the Afghan people, I think a lot of people would have the same reaction that me and Imran have, which is sort of yes and, you know.
Right. You know, I have to say the one thing that didn't get much attention and that we were really struck by was just how U.S. officials talked about Afghans. I mean, even the reporter who wrote the piece, let me find the name, Craig Whitlock wrote in the piece, U.S. officials tried to create from scratch a democratic government in Kabul modeled after their own Washington. It was a foreign concept to the Afghans, who were accustomed to tribalism, monarchism, communism, and Islamic law. I mean, that sentence really stood out to me. What are your thoughts about that, Emran?
Yeah, I understand that, you know, it's kind of a bit like the white guy writing about Afghans, especially when it comes to, you know, they don't know democracy because they're from some kind of ancient tribal society, which is kind of killing each other and don't know how to vote. It's difficult to say, to describe it like that, and I understand how non-white people, people of color, also Afghans who read this, feel. Because, to be honest, I mean, if we take a look at the recent elections, let's take the 2014 election, many Afghans back then were very enthusiastic to vote, and many also went to give their votes. I've been in Kabul back then too, and I think a lot of these so-called tribal Afghans, you know, average people, a lot of them, young people, old people, they're ready to elect the leaders. So it's not that they say, we have our system, we don't like democracy. They were, at the first, they were really, really enthusiastic about it, but the corrupt elite that Ali already mentioned, you know, people who benefit of the status quo and of the continuation of the war, they do everything to destroy the hope of the people. In 2014, you know, people went to vote, and at the end it was then Foreign Secretary John Kerry who decided who has to become president. And now the recent election, the recent presidential election, is also just kind of a flop because we still don't have real results or anything, and these corrupt elites are just fighting with each other. So I think, you know, average people are ready for that, but these corrupt elites, they are not.
Ali, what would you add?
Going back to that description in the Washington Post earlier, I also think it's unfair because it's not historically accurate. Because in the last 10 years of the kingdom, democracy did come, you know, it changed from an absolute monarchy to a constitutional monarchy, and that's how we got the rise of, at that time, people who were actual Islamists, who believed in the actual idea of political Islam, not who we have today, and communists. And that's what eventually led these sorts of protests and uprisings from these two groups, and the clashes between them is what eventually led to the Soviet occupation. So I think to say that we have no sense of democracy and free thought and these sorts of political experiments is, it's completely ahistoric.
Yeah, and this came up over and over again. An unidentified U.S. soldier said special forces teams hated the Afghan police whom they trained and worked with, calling them the bottom of the barrel in the country that's already at the bottom of the barrel. I mean, I even feel uncomfortable reading some of these quotes back to both of you, but I think it's important because, well, I'm surprised that some of these comments just didn't get more attention.
Well, hold on, but what do they say about U.S. police? I had a friend who... when we lived in a house in San Jose, they were like, oh, well, he couldn't get any other job. That's why he became a policeman. So I don't think that that's a fair assessment. If you think Afghan police are bottom of the barrel, I think it's a pretty common assessment of police officers all over the world.
Well, can you talk about the costs? I mean, this is getting a lot of attention. According to estimates, the U.S. has spent about $1 trillion on the invasion, the war in Afghanistan. One unnamed executive with USAID guessed that 90% of what they spent was overkill. This person said, we lost objectivity. We were given money, told to spend it, and we did without reason. One identified contractor told government interviewers he was expected to dole out $3 million a day in a single Afghan district, roughly the size of a U.S. county. What can you both tell us about this and how it fueled corruption? Why don't you start, Emran?
Yeah, I mean, in the early days of the war, we knew all these stories about how the Americans came and they were just handing out millions of dollars. I mean, this was well known before these papers have been published. But I think that, not sure if you followed the most recent interview of former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who said that this money also kind of fed the corruption. Now, many people also criticized Mr. Karzai for saying that because he was the head of this government and, you know, he was kind of, you know, many people associated his government and still think of his government when you talk about corruption in Afghanistan. But I think that he's not really making a wrong point, because the Americans, they just gave the money and they just pumped the money into the country. And it was kind of obvious that this would happen. With Karzai or without Karzai, they kind of created this. And back then, I mean, I've participated in so many panels and discussions with Western officials, with, you know, Western journalists, people here, because I'm living in Europe. And every time I was saying, yeah, you know, all you guys, you're talking about the responsibility of Afghans, that they're kind of backwards, they don't know this, they don't know that. But do you know what you actually have done? Mm. And all of them mostly were like, yeah, no, not really. I mean, we just wanted to rebuild the country or whatever.
Mm.
But, yeah, I mean, it was really obvious that this would happen, because as it has been often, as you can often read in this report, the Americans, they just didn't know anything about the country. They think that they could handle this with cash.
Right.
But that was totally wrong.
What would you add on that one, Ali, on the money that's been spent?
I mean, the problem with the money is that it was ridiculously spent. You know, you looked at sort of like buying, what was it, like $28 million on uniforms that were made for, say, like a forest environment, when only 2% of this country is forested, you know.
Wow.
Gas stations that cost millions and millions of dollars, a blood bank in Mazar that was completely unfunctional, I think it was made by the French. So many of these other sorts of projects that, you know, there was no oversight on, that there was no thought put into it. You know, I was just told recently about a project about like women embroidering that USAID gave out for $10 million, where $8.5 million of it is apparently set aside for administrative costs, which technically means most of that money is probably going back out to the West. Or, for instance, I can say I was asked to work with the UN for like this report about this area that they're doing quote-unquote economic development on. And they ended up bringing a photographer from London, a producer from Geneva, and a cameraman from Beirut, you know, and housing them for 7 days. So now you have to wonder, you know, if you're trying to economically empower an area, what's a better use of your money? You know, bringing and housing those people from across the world to do jobs that many young Afghans can do now, or spending that money on them. You know, so there's no real forethought. And at the same time, in terms of like just dumping money into Afghanistan, what it did was it got people used to this idea of free money, of money that just essentially rains down and is never going to end. You don't know how many like cab drivers and restaurant workers and things like that, you know, tell me that we used to work on a base, or we used to work at an embassy, or we used to work for a media agency or an NGO or whatever, who, you know, were making hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a month, who are now lucky if they make $100 a month, and had no real plan or idea that, you know, this money would someday end and that they would have to save. It's really created this artificial, messed up economy with this false idea of money that's going to rain down from the sky.
Another person in the report said the underlying problematic assumption is that Afghanistan is a country with little hope for reform and modernization, with people who can't handle or do not want democracy. There were so many lines like that in this report. And, you know, we thought it's so important to get Afghans to comment on this, because I've heard from no Afghans, and I haven't seen anyone really point out these pretty racist opinions about what happens in Afghanistan. Today we're joined by Emran Faraz, an independent journalist, author, and founder of the Drone Memorial. It's a virtual memorial for civilian drone strike victims. His work has appeared in many publications. He wrote a recent piece for Foreign Policy magazine called How Ordinary Afghans Are Living the Afghanistan Papers. We're also joined by Ali Latifi. He's a freelance journalist based in Kabul, and he's got a lengthy piece in the MIT Technology Review called Life in the Most Drone-Bombed Country in the World. The war in Afghanistan has turned the country into an unwilling testing ground for warfare technology. If you have any questions for for Ali or Emron. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And with all the coverage of the Afghanistan papers, what really stands out for you? So what we're hearing mostly in the U.S. is about the lies about the war, the mismanagement of billions of dollars. But the one thing that we're not hearing about, which has devastated the people in Afghanistan, are the nightly raids and the drone war, which you both tweet about regularly. And Ali, you have this very long piece in MIT Tech Review. As of August 31st, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, they've documented at least 4,251 aerial strikes in Afghanistan for 2019, more than double the total of 2018. That's right, Ali?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so tell us, you started your piece off talking about Khalid. He's 10 years old. You write, he still remembers the first time he heard the drones. He was sitting in his school classroom in Kogyani, a district near the Durandlan in eastern Afghanistan's Nangarhar province. Tell us about Khalid.
He's just a young, he's 20-something now. The story started out when he was 10. But he's very, and, you know, Imran has been to Khogyani too. We've been there together. He's very indicative of, a young man growing up in many parts of Afghanistan, but especially in a district like Khogyani, where, you know, he says, like, the story goes, he hears about a drone, and then he asks his teacher, what is a drone? And the teacher says, it's something that once you come to its attention, you'll never live to see tomorrow. And it's really sort of the truth of the situation, because, people have had to sort of deal with this society or this situation where, you know, you have these nightly raids where either it's night raids where U.S. and Afghan soldiers will come into your house and, you know, they'll basically ransack the house and people will disappear. Some will be killed. Some will be attacked. Or you have, you know, drones who fly overhead and drop bombs on you. It's unfortunately not, you know, Khalid's case is not unique. That's sort of what I was trying to say in the piece. And it's only getting worse. You know, we have to remember that this is something that really took off under the Obama administration and only got worse and worse under the Trump administration. So this is something that dates back a lot, almost a decade now. Well, more than a decade, but really in terms of getting really bad, at least a decade now in Afghanistan, where it's really the reality of people, you know, where they they're listening for the drone sounds and they're keeping watch and trying to understand what areas are being raided at night and by who and what sorts of false information is leading to these raids.
You also report that military activity is on the rise. The number of U.S. troops started rising under the Trump administration. There are 15,000 American military personnel officially deployed in the country. And overall, airstrikes are at a record high. 2018 saw 7,362 bombs dropped by U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
Right. And this is, you know, this is something that, again, when we were talking sort of about this idea of Afghan officials and their role, you know, in the beginning, Afghan officials were really very happy with the Trump administration because they were thinking they might be one of the only governments in the world that actually really liked Trump in the beginning, where they felt like, you know, Trump would bring more soldiers to Afghanistan. He would bring more attention to Afghanistan. And in reality, what he's done is, yes, he's increased the troop he increases and he decreases the troop level. But really what he's done is just increase the violence. And it's really increasing the violence in the most horrific ways. So you're talking about airstrikes, you're talking about drone strikes, and you're talking about essentially the reinvigorating of night raids, which were a hugely controversial practice throughout the entire war in Afghanistan. And so this joy for Trump amongst the elites is actually causing a lot of heartache and a lot of pain for the average person, you know, who's becoming victim, because he keeps saying, like, we're going to strike the Taliban hard and we're going to go after them and we're going to show no mercy. But in doing that, he's also greatly affecting the lives of ordinary Afghan people in remote areas where a lot of people can't report from. Mm.
That is Ali Latifi. He's a freelance journalist based in Kabul. Emran Faraz is an independent journalist who also tracks drones. He's founder of the Drone Memorial. Emran, you've been tracking aerial operations since 2011, and in one of your pieces, you write, "The central problem is most of these strikes are conducted under the cover of night in hard-to-reach areas, often under the control or influence of groups like the Taliban, which makes it very difficult for anyone to go and investigate in a timely manner." So can you tell us more about this and how these raids actually happen?
Yes. Yeah, so as Ali mentioned, I mean, we are reporting colleagues and also to Khogani back then. We went there together. And the thing is, as you just said, these places, and as I've written in this piece, I'm always repeating this over and over again, because these places are very remote, difficult to reach. Also, you know, in the case, even if they are not difficult to reach, people, many journalists, they don't go to these places. So also when I and Ali, when we went there back then, you know, and people were like, "Yeah, you guys are crazy, you're nuts, what are you doing? Too dangerous, why are you risking your life?" And I think that's a real problem, because there is a huge gap between Afghanistan's rural areas and its urban areas. And all the things we are talking about now, the drone strikes, night raids, all these things happen in Afghanistan's rural areas. And you know, all the bombs that are being dropped on Afghanistan. I mean, you don't see any airstrikes in Kabul or in the city of Mazar-e-Sharif or Herat. All of them are remote, and this gap that has been created is kind of problematic, because people in the city tend to not care really about what is happening in the villages. And in terms of reporting, I think it's just really, really... I mean, it's understandable that the journalist colleagues don't want to go to these places, but they have to be covered somehow, because all these things are taking place there. For example, the night raids. I mean, there are different players involved in these night raids. For example, there are Afghan militias who are backed by the CIA, and they are present in different parts of the country. For example, there's the 01 unit, the 02 unit, the so-called Khost Protection Force, which is in the eastern province of Khost and in the provinces of Paktia and Paktika. And they are really, really brutal. So they are being paid by the Americans to conduct these raids, and mostly they do this in a very brutal way, attacking civilian homes, executing the people, abducting them, torturing them, all of this. You know, they do that kind of stuff. And they are also co-working with U.S. soldiers, and you know, all of that because of the so-called war on terror. But actually, I mean, recently I talked with someone about the raid that took place in Wardak province in the near of Kabul, and this person, who himself had a pro-government stance, talked about this raid, and I think 7 civilians were killed in this raid, which was also conducted by both Afghan soldiers and American soldiers. And he was like, "Yeah, I don't like the Taliban, but because of that raid, the whole village is now pro-Taliban. All of them support them now," which is very obvious and understandable in some ways. So the Afghan government must not let this happen, but it continues to happen, and that's a huge problem.
Ali, you also report on information warfare, the Americans taking photos, fingerprints, and iris scans of almost every Afghan they came across in 2007. We're almost out of time, but I want to ask both of you, what do you hear from people on the ground when you interview them? What changes do they want? Do they want the United States to completely leave at this point? Ali?
There are a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, yes, there are a lot of people that you know, feel like, you know, they've sort of outlasted their usefulness, and they haven't really contributed much more. I mean, I think if you, at the end of the day, all I've been asked this many times, and I think people sort of seem to forget that all anybody here wants are very, very simple. Step one is obviously this idea of peace, some idea of peace and stability where you can go to work or you can go to school without having to worry about a suicide bomber on the ground or a drone bomb in the sky. And the idea of just basically having of just having basic, simple services, you know, 24-hour electricity, running water, proper roads, access to hospitals, access to schools with real books and desks and pencils, and the ability to get a job, the ability to go to school if you want to, or if you don't want to go to school, you don't want to go to school. But just literally, you know, all people want is a chance at a normal life at this point. And I think that's why, even though we didn't fully discuss it, but I think that's why there's a lot of people that are so desperate for this peace agreement in Doha, because at the end of the day, you know, people are hoping that there'll just be a chance at a normal life once again. That's the only thing that anybody really wants here.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. We would love to have both of you back. Thank you so much for all of your work. Emran Faraz is an independent journalist and author and founder of The Drone Memorial, a virtual memorial for civilian drone strike victims. And Ali Latifi is a freelance journalist. You can find their reporting at yourcallradio.org. Ali and Emran, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Jonathan Linden, our intern, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can sign up for our podcast and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.